Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being with us on another Sunday morning. Today, we're going to do a show on physics, or physics for the masses. Our guest today, Professor Lewis Bloomfield. He's a professor of physics at the University of Virginia and has been there since 1985. Specializes in, hold your heads on, experimental atomic, molecular, and optical physics, experimental chemical physics, experimental condensed matter physics. He's an author in his field, but also someone who helps explain physics to the general public through articles, as well as a television co-host on the Discovery Channel's former show, Some Assembly Required. Professor Bloomfield has also been awarded the Jefferson Scholars Faculty Prize for his leadership and citizenship, while being especially noted of his passion and commitment to his students. Professor Bloomfield, thank you so much for being the guest today.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, I'm very excited to have you on and to learn a little bit. I haven't taken physics since 1981, 82, and I don't think I did very well at the time. So I'm trusting that you can up my grade a little bit.
It's a little late here to be going back and fixing it, but I'll try.
Well, let's start with the basics. I'm always curious about what gets someone so into physics that they move on to become a professor.
Oh boy, I was pretty much born into the role. I just, as a little kid, I was already taking stuff apart and putting it back together, basically trying to figure out what things were, what made them tick, how things work. And it's, I didn't know it at the time that that was going to become a lifelong thing, but it's still with me many years since that, the start.
Well, not everyone has the desire or care / concern to make it simple and interesting for others. There are certainly plenty of scientists, and that's the stereotype, of those who just do their thing, talk their science, their jargon, and if you don't understand them, so be it. But you have the reputation of teaching others and making it interesting, and I'll use the word simplifying it in the best way possible to help understanding. Why is that?
That was a surprise to me. I always liked doing physics, that is, looking at the world around me and trying to figure it out. But the fact that I like to help other people understand it was kind of a surprise to me. That showed up about 1990. I found that, I mean, my historical revisionist argument is that I got tired of going to, say, cocktail parties or something equivalent and being asked, what do you do? And I would say, oh, I'm a physicist. And that would inevitably end the conversation. I just didn't like this anymore. Like, what's wrong with physics? We're not all pointy headed geeks. And so that compulsion, basically, to try to become part of the real world again, plus a number of minor things that were happening in life at the university, got me thinking that, well, if I wanted to bring in students that and teach them something useful, let me turn the physics classes inside out, and let me teach, instead of teaching all the dry, abstract physics that's conventionally taught, let me explain the world for people, explain things people care about. How does television work? How does a radio work? How does a light bulb work? How does your oven work? How does a music station work? So, radio station. And so I started doing that, and I created a course out of, essentially out of thin air, which is hard work, not following well-worn paths. I created a course called How Things Work, and it became very popular. And ultimately, I've taught it most semesters for going on 30 years. I'm probably toward the end of that process, but it's over those years, I've had more than 10,000 students at the university, and in other venues, hundreds of thousands of people. So it's become a real mission in life for me, which is kind of gratifying and fun.
Well, I clap my hands as best I can to your work and helping everyone along, because you're right. It's your course is very popular. It's quite well known at the university for its interest amongst the general student population. So great work for 30 years. Good grief. But let's start with the general listenership at the Wren. One of the things that, as I did my homework, that I found interesting, it's not just how things are explained in terms of how your oven works and how a radio station works. It's also explaining or defying some basic myths. And the myth that I want to open with today is a penny falling from a skyscraper will kill you. And you did you didn't just do a study on that. You went out there and did it.
Yeah. In fact, we tried to get skyscrapers to let us drop pennies so that I could catch them. But oddly enough, no one wants to let you do that because they're so scared of that myth. But it really is. It really is a myth. The penny doesn't fall very fast at all. It flutters down. It comes down more like a butterfly fall, a heavy butterfly falling, than it does a rocket ship. So I measured the speed at which pennies move through the air if you drop them essentially from very great height. I didn't go to very great height in that measurement. I did it in my laboratory. The penny only comes out at about 25 miles an hour, which isn't all that fast. In fact, it's slow enough that you can catch them if you're a decent catch, which unfortunately I'm not. I tried. I tried to catch them drop from great height, but they kept bouncing off of me. Still, they didn't hurt. But since we couldn't get a skyscraper to let us do this, or even any building, we did it from a hot air balloon. Well, not a hot air balloon, a helium balloon. We launched a helium balloon in McIntyre Park. I got permission from a parks recs to do that. And I made a penny dispenser that would spit out pennies on command. And I then went around below the balloon trying to catch the pennies as they fluttered down. And even though I wasn't successful at catching them, I probably should have enlisted some of the good athletes that know what they're doing. It's still the myth is just a myth. Don't worry about pennies.
So, is there any understanding as to how the myth gets started, and to without going deep in the weeds, is I don't know if that's possible for a physicist you say that the penny flutters. Why is that?
It's all about the air. When you take a basic physics course, you talk about things falling, and people sort of set aside the air because that's a nuisance. And you just look at the simple physics of something falling, and it goes faster and faster and faster. And so when you're asked on an exam to calculate how fast is some object going to be traveling after it's been dropped from 50,000 feet, and you do the calculation even vaguely correctly, it's going to be going really fast. But that's a completely unrealistic situation. The world has air, and air is not something to be set aside. If you drop something through air, the air begins to exert air resistance on it. And so this is certainly true of skydivers. They don't come down faster and faster and faster. It's all about air when you're skydiving. And finally, when you open your parachute, you come down at a sort of a safe speed, in fact. The Penny has the same thing. It's its own parachute. It comes down relatively slowly because the air is just all about interacting with the air. Same thing with rain. Think how high rain or hail, how high they come from, and yet they don't come through and kill you either. So thank goodness for the air and air resistance. And again, the stuff coming off a skyscraper, worry about the stuff that's really streamlined, like a ballpoint pen. That's probably not a good thing to throw off the Empire State Building. But pennies, they're no problem.
Again, our guest today is Professor Lewis Bloomfield. He's a professor of physics at the University of Virginia. We're going to be talking about physics today. He's going to help us understand some physics. He's going to talk about some of the places that he's visited, seeing how things are made. So let's do that real quick. The Wren is a radio station that plays music. And on your Discovery Channel TV show, Some Assembly Required, talk about that and then tell us about the Les Paul electric guitar.
That show, Some Assembly Required, was just the most fun experience for me as a scientist. It wasn't my day job. You know, I'm a professor, but I was going out there kind of as this off-time gig to go and make things at companies. So that my role in that show was as the science co-host, and we would go to companies, and the main host, Brian, would actually do most of the making. He would jump into the assembly line, as it were, and be making stuff, and I would be talking about the making it. Sometimes I got to make it, which was fun too. But we went all over the country and occasionally outside the country to companies large and small to make things that you are familiar with. And one of the things that we jumped in to make was guitars at Gibson outside Nashville. And it was wonderful. Gibson guitar, this was the electric guitar facility, and it's populated by musicians who love their work. They love making guitars. A good fraction of them are they're all musicians pretty much, and they have their bands and they have their gigs and they also make guitars. And we did everything from working with the wood right up front, the facilities for cutting, for drying the wood. So they get these exotic woods from all over the world. They dry them carefully because you know how wood tends to warp if you're not careful with it. So they're making it very sure that the guitars will hold their shape. Then they cut them in various ways. A lot of it's computerized because it's just making the shapes is so clearly very challenging if you had to do it by hand. And then they get the guitar in shape, the physical structure of the guitar, and then all the little steps of putting a neck on the body, putting the strings on the strut, the frets, and all the electronics, putting in the pickups. And I got to go along and sort of look at all the, there's a lot of technology in the guitar. Even just in the neck, one of the fun experiences there was the neck of the guitar has to stay straight and stiff despite all the tension in the strings. And if there weren't some technology hidden in that neck, it would bend over as you tightened the strings and it would lose its tune. So they put a rod in there and a sort of careful structure that they've designed that when you tighten that rod, it bows the neck away from the strings. So it fights the string tension. So I was having a great time trying to explain the physics of that neck because I thought it was fascinating. And I was so wrapped up in that when we finished the shot that I was holding onto the neck of the guitar. And the next thing I know, I was getting into the car because we had to go make a plane flight and go back to do other things. And I still have that neck. I've never gave it back to them. So sorry, Gibson, if you know, it's been a little while, but if you really want it back, I'll return it.
Oh, Professor Bloomfield, it was a TV show on the Discovery Channel, Some Assembly Required. You can find bits and pieces of it on YouTube. I found the ones I found were pretty fun, so take a look. One of the things that you're also known for are the things that you do in your classes. I mentioned at the start of the show about how you make things pretty easy for the general student population, or that's your goal, and how your class has become well known for that. What are some of your more popular lessons?
Well, the topics themselves, let's see. I'm thinking of demonstrations first. Let me focus first on a demonstration that I associate with skating and skateboarding and really any of the activities that you do where you coast. Most of the time with skating, you're coasting, or at least I am if I go skating. I'm not like doing figure eights. So the whole idea of how does coasting work? And what that brings to mind to me is inertia. And so I start out my whole class with a demonstration of inertia that's familiar to people. It's pulling the tablecloth out from underneath the play settings. And it's often spoken about as a trick. And it's not a trick at all. In fact, if you want to go back to why do I teach physics for non-scientists and you know, what motivates me and interests me, it's I want to explain the world to them. I want to give away all the secrets. So I consider myself an unmagician. I'm doing the opposite of magic. It's common in physics courses for the instructor to want to sort of feel superior and want to be the magician. And I'm trying to do the opposite. I'm trying to not to blow away my audience and confuse them or make them think I'm a superstar. I just want to give away the secrets. And so the tablecloth trick is one of those. And it's one that anybody can do, even without a tablecloth. Just put objects on a sheet of paper. And those objects tend to stay put because of inertia. That's their nature. That's what they do for a living. And if you snap that piece of paper out from underneath the objects quickly, you'll leave the objects behind. So throw some coins there, silverware, a plate. You can just whisk the sheet out from under them, and they'll stay put not because something's holding them there, but because that is the nature of our universe. Inertia, objects at rest tend to stay at rest. And if you don't bug them much, they will stay at rest.
Again, our guest today, Professor Lewis Bloomfield, professor of physics at the University of Virginia, talking to us today a little bit about physics for the general public. Let's take a break and we'll be right back. And thank you for being here with us again today. And thanks to 97.9 The Wren. Always glad to be back for another week. And glad to have Professor Lewis Bloomfield with us as we learn about physics for the masses. Professor Bloomfield, I read an article that you had written about, it was something to do with crucial math for social distancing in these times. Can you talk about that for a bit?
Well, there are a number of roles that physics in particular, but science in general can play in trying to deal with controlling the pandemic. And social distancing, the point there is that once people began to realize that the virus travels in part through the air or through the space between people, the question was, how far away did people have to be to really minimize or at least seriously reduce the possibility the virus would move from one person to the other through the air or through empty space or the space between them? And at least early on, people were pretty focused on droplets coming out of your mouth. And if you talk or as you sneeze or cough, little droplets come out, and once they're free of you, they're little falling objects. And lo and behold, we're back to falling pennies. Do those droplets go straight as an arrow? No, because they're falling. So they arc downward and they eventually hit the ground. That assumes, of course, that they're able to make their way through the air pretty well. And at least early on, the general thought was, yeah, they make it through the air pretty well because they're pretty big and they fall more like raindrops than anything else. And so the question was, how far away do you have to be to sort of avoid the falling rain from somebody who might be infected and might cause you trouble? And the general consensus of people who are more expert in this obviously than I am, was that about 6 feet or the metric version is sort of 2 meters is about far enough that you're not going to get rained on. And that's that remains the sort of the gold standard. You want to be about that far away. You don't really want these droplets landing on you because they potentially can cause you trouble. Subsequently, people started to realize that it's not just it's not the big drops that matter. It's actually the little tiny ones, the aerosols. And I don't think I've ever seen a good statement about what the aerosols are like and why they're different from the droplets. So let me give you one for the first time here. And that is that the little tiny ones, they're like dust particles. Maybe a little droplet of mostly water, but also the virus. They're like dust particles, and they don't fall very well. You watch dust in a sunny day, slow-moving dust in a room with the air not moving much. You can see them float. They seem to be floating. They're not really floating. They're just falling really slowly because they have terrible air resistance problems. And so if the air moves, so do those little particles. And they can move around long distances. And that, alas, seems to be part of life with this virus. It all, not only does it travel in the droplets, which are big enough to descend kind of like rain, it also travels in the tiny aerosols, which are more like dust. And there's not really a good safe distance to get away from those little guys. So that's why wearing masks is really helpful. You just try to keep the dust, those little dusty particles from coming out of your mouth or going into your mouth. Just block them. And alternatively, be in a place where the airflow is good. So basically they get whisked away and aren't just hovering around among you and your friends. So this is sort of the physics basis behind why we don't have we're discouraged from having large congregations of people. Get away from these tiny floating particles and do it outside where the wind will whisk them away and send them off so that they never encounter people, or at least not before they've degraded because of sunlight or other things that finally sort of kill off the virus particles.
I don't know. If you had a classroom, and I say if you had a classroom or many viewers taking your class virtually, and you wanted to show this scientifically, how would you do that?
Well, that's a fun question. For the droplets, I would just spray droplets out of some sort of mister. I don't really want them aerosols. So I want little droplets, and maybe on a sheet of paper, we could put red ink in the water and spray it out. You'd see all the red droplets would land within a sort of a certain radius around the sprayer. Because they go out, they fall, and they land. And probably that radius, assuming we don't spray super fast, much faster than a human would spit these things out of their mouth, they're going to all mostly fall within about 6 feet of the source. But then you put in the little aerosol creator that just makes a mist. And now because these particles are so small and they travel, we want to make them even more visible than just putting red dye in. So let me put in the fluorescent green of antifreeze, which is a chemical known as sodium fluorescein. And it just lights up in ultraviolet light. If you never noticed that, you take some, it's like highlighter. You take that into black light, so-called black light, which is really ultraviolet, and it just glows like crazy. So if you do that mister trick again, with sodium fluorescein in the liquid, you'll be able to see, and do it in the dark with the ultraviolet light on, you'll see these particles drifting around the room. They'll go forever. And there actually have been some photographs I've seen online of this sort of thing, where they have a pretend person, a mannequin, sort of creating an aerosol of the little droplets, and you can see them swirl around. They go around like smoke drifting through the air, and off they go, and they follow the air currents and little eddies and all of that. And, it's all fun and games with the fluorescent dye, and you can light it up. It's not such fun and games, of course, if there's the virus in there. So, but that's what I would do for my class. I would turn off the lights. I'd have aerosol sprayer make those little green, neon green glowing droplets and light them up. And you'd watch him drift around the classroom.
Again, our guest today, Professor Lewis Bloomfield, professor of physics at the University of Virginia. So, Professor, let's go back to your Discovery Channel program that you did a number of years ago, Some Assembly Required, and talk about some of the other businesses that you visited. We talked about the Les Paul electric guitar. You also did John Deere riding mowers.
Yeah, that was and they're all fun. That was fun. That was up in Horicon, Wisconsin, and we went up there, and they make the mowers, the whole thing, soup to nuts. And we participated in the whole sequence from taking sheet metal and structuring it, essentially molding it and machining it and molding it to create the frame of the lawnmower, the cutting area, the blades of that. So it was just fantastic metalwork, lots of fun with that. And painting it, the famous John Deere green, they use powder. It's electrostatic powder coating. They put electric charge. I mean, this is for a physicist. This is like kid in a candy store, right? They put one electric charge on the mower, and they put the other electric charge on the these particles of green paint. They're little tiny particles, and it's opposite charges attract, right? Wham! You set this up as there's 100,000 volts between these two objects. And the physics of what is a volt, who cares right now? But in my class, I would do that. But they stick to each other like glue. So those paint particles are just whammed onto the surface of the mower, and then they send it through an oven, and they bake those particles the particles go from being particles to being a continuous layer of paint. And that's why, of course, they're not the only people that use this technique, but that's why those coatings are so tough. They're really plastic, just cooked right onto the surface. Oh, so what else with those mowers? The lawnmowers. I'll give you one more physics tidbit there that's related to my tablecloth trick. How do you cut grass with only one blade? It's not like scissors where you have two blades and you slice, you squeeze the grass between two blades. It's one blade comes along and just slices off the grasses. And that's inertia. You know, what holds the grass in place while the blade comes along? Inertia. It's the natural tendency of the grass to keep doing what it's doing. It starts at rest, and the blade comes along, whack. And that's why the blade has to move so fast. It's not just to get the job done in a hurry. It's because if you come up on the grass at 1 mile an hour, the grass is going to have plenty of time to sort of pick up speed and move out of your way. But if you come at it at 150 or 200 miles an hour, which is what a lawnmower, a rotary lawnmower like the John Deere's we made, moves at, that blade just goes right through the grass. The grass has no time to get out of the way.
I've always found that the problem with lawn mowing inertia is that I don't get off the sofa to go cut it.
Yeah, social inertia is a big problem. I experienced it myself.
So what are some of the other things that I see? Jelly bellies.
Yep, another fun trip. That's out in California, near Sacramento. And making the jelly bellies, they start by forming a little jelly nugget. They squirt out a little nugget of jelly, of hot jelly, so it's molten, into starch. And they collect lots of these little jelly centers. And some of them they're already flavored to some extent there to begin with. And then the big challenge is taking that little jelly center and building it up into a full jelly bean. And that's done in mixers, kind of like a cement mixer, but on very small scale. And there are workers that go around as these mixers are turning, adding sugar and flavor and color and just building up a coating over a period of time on those jelly bellies. And eventually they're complete. They may put a sort of final glaze coating on there, or maybe a wax. I can't remember exactly. But then the issue is making sure they're all perfect. And you really can't have them hand inspected, right? There are too many jelly bellies. So they send them through sifters. They sift them first for jelly bellies that are too small. And then they sift them for jelly bellies that are too big. So the ones that are too small, something went wrong. I don't know where those ones go. But the ones that are too big, that basically don't go through the proper size sieve, those go into bags and are sold locally there as belly flops. So at some point, I was giving all my friends, I bought a whole bunch of belly flops, some of which are ginormous things. Everything that possibly can go wrong ultimately does eventually. So I was giving them to friends. And actually, on that particular trip, the jelly belly trip, my son was able to join us at the time. And he was in high school, I guess. He had fun because there were the Harry Potter flavors.
Oh yeah!
And so I would say he had fun tasting all the Harry Potter flavors. We watched them make snot, which is not a particularly interesting flavor to me. Aaron, my son, said that it basically tastes just mostly salty, but he regretted tasting vomit. So Personally, I'm a fan of the more fruit flavor ones than the Harry Potter flavors.
I always assumed that they were just a bunch of sugar with a little bit of flavoring that were then somehow melted into the proper texture.
It's a whole building up process. the jelly beans of my youth, the ones I remember were really simple. They were probably a molded ball of sweet jelly with a sugar wrapper on there. I'm not sure how much sophistication went into the production of those. The Jelly Bellies, they work pretty hard on those things. They're trying to get the flavors right, and meaningful and interesting, but they're also trying to get a good structure the whole way. So it's, you think that little guy is just like totally low tech. It's not. It's a fairly intense process trying to go from just the little jelly nugget to start with. There were a lot of steps. There are a lot of kitchens, in a sense, that are making the various ingredients and trying to get them right in enormous quantities. So,
did you get to see any of the flavors in process?
I certainly saw many flavors being made.
I meant to see whatever the phrase I want to use is, but something they hadn't come up with yet, the research and development.
Oh, yeah. Yes, that was the other possibilities. Yeah, absolutely. They have a laboratory there where they analyze flavors they're interested in turning into a jelly bean. So, I mean, a simple choice would be just to pick a fruit. I mean, a cherry. So, you know, so what's in the cherry flavor? So they analyze it and they use laboratory equipment like you'd see at a university chemistry, high-tech research lab. They're using gas chromatographs and other things that are trying to find out what are all the subtle flavors. And so, and then they put them together and they test them. You know, I'm not the world's greatest taster, but I was tasting some of these flavors. I don't remember them sending by I don't think I tasted one of their innovative, like the next generation flavors, but they were certainly working on them. They're all very enthusiastic about trying to bring in new flavors.
Again, our guest today is Professor Lewis Bloomfield from the Physics Department at the University of Virginia. Let's take our next break, and we'll come back and we'll talk about some more visits from the Some Assembly Required show. We'll talk about where Professor Bloomfield described how a bus driver could have caught a girl falling from the third floor. And we'll also talk about his current research as well. So hang tight. Be right back. All right. Happy Sunday morning. Thank you, Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Wishes everyone a lovely day. Professor Bloomfield with us here again today, talking about physics for the masses, giving us a little explanation on how things work. Professor, you had made an explanation in a newspaper article, or maybe this was on a television show, and I read the text of it, about how a bus driver made a heroic catch of a girl who'd fallen from the third floor without having his arms fall off. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, just in general, over the years, I've sort of become a go-to person for explaining the science of things that just pop up in everyday life. And so that was what happened here. I got called by a reporter after the fact, obviously, where a toddler, basically, was standing on the air conditioning unit three stories up, and people were it's almost like out of a movie. Oh my God. And the people were there gawking, thinking, oh, you know, disaster's about to occur. And a bus driver went up there and stood under the air conditioner. And alas, sure enough, this toddler toddled off the air conditioning unit, having gone out the window over on the air conditioning unit, and off she came. And he was thinking to himself, oh my God, I hope I can catch her, and whatever. And he did. And he caught her the right way, which is to say that he let her land on him, and he yielded. He moved with her as he brought her to a stop. I think he fell over in the process, and but they were all okay. And the reason that works is it's like dropping anything that's coming fast, catching anything that comes. For example, an egg. If you've ever done an egg toss back and forth, if the egg is coming at you fast, which like the toddler, you don't want to catch it suddenly. You don't want to stop it in an instant, because that asks it to give you all of its forward momentum, or if it's falling, downward momentum, too fast. And it does that by way of huge forces, which hurt, which destroy the egg. So if you catch that egg with your hand and you don't move, you will shatter the egg. The impact forces will be horrible. But if you let the egg land on your hand and you let your hand move with the egg for a while, basically use as much room as you have, available, you can catch the egg safely. And that's what this bus driver did. He caught the girl, the toddler, safely by slowing to a stop between where he was reaching up to all the way to the pavement. He may never have thought of this as he was doing it, but he did it right. And so she was okay.
Did he break an arm? Do you remember this?
I vaguely remember. I don't think anybody was broken. I think he was okay. And I think that the toddler was okay. I think they may have probably, I'm sure they checked everybody out, but there were no significant injuries as far as I remember. And it makes sense. I mean, you think of the comic book hero stuff where the damsel in distress falls. This is back before PC era. It was the damsel, of course, who falls from the high rise, and Superman or somebody equivalent catches her 3 inches off the pavement. Well, that ain't going to work, because to stop her 3 inches off the pavement and bring her to rest, Superman would have to push on her as hard as the pavement would have, and it's going to be mighty bad for her. So that's all hooey. But this one was right. This is done correctly. You can catch something that's coming from pretty good height if you let it, if you move with it. It's the same as catching a football. If you want to catch a football safely, let it move you. Years ago, I did another physics of football with the Ravens in Baltimore. And we talked with one of the star receivers back then, and talked about the catching process, that if you have brick hands, you don't move, the ball bounces off you. But you got to move with the ball to catch it.
Talk about, you're doing your own current research. You're not just teaching others about the history of physics through explanations, but you've invented something.
Yep. My research has been eclectic over the years. I mean, it changed. And for the past about 10 years, I've been studying a material of my own invention, which is very similar to silly putty. So a lot of people are familiar with it from childhood. It's this wacky putty that bounces around if you drop it. And it snaps if you pull it fast, it breaks. But you can mold it in whatever shape you like if you go slowly. Well, I've invented a solid version of silly putty. And you know, I think, what does solid mean if it's putty? Well, it's got a shape now. It's a permanent shape. Silly putty has no permanent shape. You can mold it to whatever shape you like. It doesn't have it. It's indifferent. But I can mold it into a shape. For example, into an earplug. And the earplug shape I have in mind that we've actually developed looks like a chess pawn. So it's got a bulb at one end and a stem a little bit. And you can mold that. That's its preferred shape. But you can mush it out of shape just like you can silly putty and stick it in your ear. And then over some period of time, in seconds or minutes, it goes back. It tries to go back to its pawn shape, and in doing that, it blocks your ear. So it blocks the sound, and it seals perfectly. And we've designed it so it's so gentle in its return to its original pawn shape, that once it encounters your ear canal, it just stops caring. It's happy. It stays in that new shape, and you barely feel that it's in your ear. So this is a case where the research in the laboratory studying this material, and it has interesting, I would say fascinating scientific issues that I can do mathematically at great length. But it's also practical. Yeah. I mean, the mathematics is fun. It's the first time I've ever published a paper where they're like 80 equations. And some of the equations are many lines long and uses calculus. It's horrendous looking, but really the practical issue, this material is actually useful. It's great for human padding. It should be down the road. It should be in every hand grip because it gets rid of pressure points. If you make a disc of this and say kneel on it, so for a knee pad, it wants to be a disc or a sheet, but it will move out of the way and adopt a new shape. As you kneel on it, and so it will move out of the way of any knobs on your knees or the parts that normally get irritated. And then it will be happy in its new shape until you get off and let it gradually drift back to its original shape. But it makes great pads then. So for hand grips on a cane, on a bicycle handle, on just gloves themselves, on prosthetics, in shoes. Somewhere down the line, we're going to have all these products. But the elephant in the corner is that I've invented this at the university and done some pretty good science with it. But I've also trying to make a tiny little company. It's more like a hobby company at this point, to try to make it, bring it out into the real world. And so we actually do have the earplugs in production, and on Amazon they're called ear jellies, and they're actually really good. They're the first sort of new earplug material in 30 or 40 years, and basically all the other companies are just rehashing existing materials, but we've got a new material. And
so am I using these for because my partner snores, or because I'm going to the rock concert, or because I'm a construction worker and I run the air, the hammer jack? At what level of noise would I want to purchase this?
My answer is yes, as in all of those. It's one of those multiple choice questions where I go, they're all good. One of our main targets really is snorers, because people who have partners who snore and try to use other earplugs, often the earplugs either fall out or become uncomfortable or itchy, drive you crazy. And the ear jellies, because they're ultimately extremely soft, in the sense that they care very little about being adopting a new shape and holding it for a very long period of time. They want to go back to being their original shape, but it's such a tiny influence that they're really soft. And so they seal your ears and you don't feel them. They're not pressing on your ear all night.
Am I going to hear my phone when it rings because there's an emergency from elsewhere in my life?
Yes. No earplugs are true. Block all sound. In fact, they can't, because the sound gets into your ear through your skin, your flesh, in ways. So there's just no, even if you completely occlude the ear put glue in there, you'll still hear sound. You can only attenuate it so much. So you'll hear it. But the issue here is that these take down the volume by about 25 decibels or 30 decibels, which is quite significant, but you still can hear. It's just everything's much quieter. And in terms of rock concerts and musicians, and this being, as you point out, this is a music station, right? They are acoustically pretty flat. That is, they handle all frequencies about evenly, which is not true of other earplugs. So a lot of earplugs, they distort the sound. because they block high frequencies much better than they block low frequencies. And so that's already a problem for speech. It's harder to understand people because you lose the high frequencies, which are present in some of the sounds, like the S's, the sibilant sounds. You lose those before you lose the low frequencies. Low frequencies are hard to block, as anyone who has had a car go by with all the big speakers in them, you get the bass beat. It goes right through all the car doors and windows and stuff. But okay, anyway, most earplugs block the high frequencies, let the low frequencies through. Our earplugs, because of the nature of the material, are pretty acoustically flat. They handle all frequencies about equally, which is good for musicians and for listening to music. It just takes down the volume without distorting it badly.
Very interesting. Professor Lewis Bloomfield talking about his own invention, the ear jelly earplugs. Professor, let's go back to some of the other places that you visited on the Discovery Channel, because we've only been through two or three, and I had listed some that I found. I was like, how in the world does that have anything to do with physics? And so I'm going to start out with this one, which is on the Some Assembly Required show. You visited Batesville Caskets.
Yeah, Batesville Caskets in Batesville, Indiana. The physics, is a lot of it's metal forming to start with. They have the biggest presses I have ever seen in my life to take sheet metal, and in one pound of the press, it reshapes a rectangle of, say, of steel into the curved, structured top of a casket. And those presses, they're a 1,000-ton press. They're the one I'm thinking of, and the one that I climbed at one point. It's like 40 feet tall, this big rotating machine. The center rotates, the frame, enormous frame sits still, of course, but there's a rotating component that has tremendous weight and mass. Round it goes, and attached to it, like the crank, like the rods in a car engine, attached to this rotating device is a kind of a piston that comes down and stomps on metal at the bottom of the press. And there will be just people feeding sheets of steel into this press. It would, about once every maybe 5-10 seconds, the piston would come down, whomp on the steel, and it would come out a finished piece of metal, ready for painting and installation. So watching those presses work, watching the welding systems. These are continuous welding, seam welding devices, where they would kind of roll two rollers on opposite sides of the metal that they're trying to join, and the electric current would go between those two rollers. The rollers were copper, and they were awash in water to keep everything cool, except right between those rollers, electric current would pass and would heat the metal up hot enough to melt it, or at least to make it pliable and sticky, and it would stick. They'd stick it together. So I could talk about the physics of forming the metal. In fact, the whole physics of steel is amazing. Steel is an entire life's, many lives' work, understanding how steel works and the possibilities. So you see the steel being welded together, the frame being put together, the fittings. Making the fittings that are on the shiny things, the chrome plating, which is done in vacuum by letting the chrome atoms move through empty space in a vacuum from a hot heated piece of chromium to the fitting that they're trying to plate, all great. And so then it finally ends up in fabric land and filling the casket with various pads and stuff like that. And one of the observations that, that my main host and I had as we were doing this is people who work there don't joke about the caskets. I mean, to us, this work was, I mean, it's a little grim, but it's also a little funny. And we just couldn't help but tell jokes to each other about all the things we were seeing. And they've got no chuckles at all. It was a little bit like visiting the Adams family or the Munsters. I mean, I don't want to speak badly of them, but it's maybe if you do this for years, you lose the chuckle. But it seemed to us just a pretty funny context. Like here you are as my co-host was saying, sort of pimping the final ride, and no chuckles. So it was an interesting, fun experience, but not a place I would fit in very well working.
Professor Lewis Bloomfield with us. Professor, we got about 1 minute left. I want you to tell us about your online course at UVA. You got about 50 seconds.
Well, I mean, right now I'm doing Zoom versions of courses, but 2013, I put the start of my course online on Coursera. I very carefully film my six first topics. I teach physics backwards. I teach the topic and find the physics in it. So skating, falling balls, ramps, things like that. I put them online at Coursera as a How Things Work course. And during the pandemic, that course has become really very popular, very widely used. And so I feel great that I've provided a place for probably a lot of K through 12 kids to study physics during the pandemic, to see physics done pretty carefully and pretty well. And it's been about 5,000 students who've actually completed the course in the past couple of months. And tens of thousands have at least dabbled in it. So good experience.
That's awesome. I'll have to see if we can include that information on how to find it in the podcast information. Professor Lewis Bloomfield today explaining and helping us learn it a little easier, physics for the general public. Professor, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You can find Professor Bloomfield in the physics department at the University of Virginia. And thank you so much. Everyone, enjoy your Sunday, and we'll be back next week.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.